Accession number 31050, Reel 2.
Were your parents particularly political?
I would say not. My mother was more intent on improving her situation. In the street, she had to be the one that looked respectable, and you had to be respectable, even if you had nothing to be respectable with. But she, and that's how she finally got herself onto that nice little Walcott Trust estate. It's all a matter of being superior. You know, she was an intelligent woman, but she was, I think, manic depressive or something. There was something not quite right about her. But I didn't get it, poor darling. She had a troublesome life.
What effect on the day-to-day life did the early stages of the war have on you?
Well, it was pretty horrendous, really, because you could only go out to your work. The first year of the war, we didn't have any bombing, so I got used to getting to work and getting home again on foot. See, if you went to the Elephant, you could get to any bridge that wasn't disabled during the bombing and get over the other side, because my whole purpose was to get across the river. So from the Elephant, you got Tower Bridge, you got all the other bridges around, and so you had to find out which bridge you could get over and walk, and same coming home. As the war progressed and we got the bombing, we had to go down into the safes every time there was an alert, and eventually they moved all the machines and all the city office into the safes, which was no daylight, and all this cement flooring which wore off, dust, the machines got full of dust and we got full of, it was and then we worked down there permanently until Phyllis, who is the middle one in the thing over there, got a very bad chest, and her boyfriend got TB, and I went to Auntie was the lady, Miss Shapcott, in charge of the girls, and said, there was no bombing now, couldn't we go up to the banking hall, which had a dome over it, you see, had chicken wire under it, but it would be very dangerous. And they did take us up and put us round the back, and she said, if Miss Pluckrose says it's bad, it is bad. I never complained, you see. And so the whole thing, and I mean, there were about 30 girls working in this area with these machines and all this dust and dirt, and it was ghastly. And when Phyllis came back from being ill, I suppose she had a chest infection too at that time. So we were all out of that. But to start with, it was very disruptive, because you went down into the safes and you couldn't do your work. Then you had to try and catch your work up when you got back up in the city office, and then you had to then you'd be late going home, and then eventually when the air raid warning started about 4 o'clock, we had to do the clearing. You know, the city banks clear their balance with each other every day, and sometimes, I mean, you laugh at it now, but there'd be a boy of about 17, a couple of girls about like me, you know, I was 17, 18 in those days, and we would walk round to some underground place, and we'd each, with the Lloyds group and the Barclays and the Midland, and, you know, we'd call a balance, and they'd repeat it back, and that was what you'd done for the day, and then you could go home, so to speak. But we were absolute kids. I mean, it was ridiculous. Most of them would be at school today, you see. And so we tried to clear the bank. The waste, as it was called, went through by 2:30. And as soon as we got it through, we could leave. And then you'd start home, but some nights, of course, you were later. And I think we had summertime all the winter and double summertime in the summer, which made it, I can't think which way around it was, but we were often going home in the dark, especially if it was foggy. So you got home, and if the warning went, you had to pick your plate up where you were just eating your tea and run to the shelter. But then I stopped doing that, and I started staying in and sitting under the kitchen table, which was a semi-basement. And that's where I was on my 19th birthday. I think that must have been the last violent bombing of London until the V2s and V1s. If I was 19, 20 would have been 42. No, it must have been, we were bombed 39, we were bombed in 41 and 42. I would have been 20, I think, then.
How closely did you follow the progress of the war elsewhere throughout the 40s and 41?
Well, eventually I got a little portable radio down in the woods. Well, a little portable radio was a sort of Bakelite job that had two accumulators that ran out every 3 days, and I had to take them into Bodmin. But we did get the invasion, and we did get Battle of the Bulge the advance into France we did get. But then I got ill and I left it down there. One of the boys had it, and of course then I came into civilised life again after that. So,
Had you been much aware of the early setbacks of Dunkirk? And
terribly. I woke up one morning. My bedroom was on the street about 6 o'clock, and two people outside were saying, yes, and Holland and France and Belgium have all fallen. And I flew out of bed. I was absolutely horrified by it. And Dunkirk occurred. I was in at Dartmouth one day, and there was a boat on the River Dart there, along the quay there, and there was a little man standing there, and I said, that boat said it went to Dunkirk. I've always been aware of the wars. That man said it went. And he said, he started to cry, and I said, oh, what is it? And he said, my boat went to Dunkirk, and my mother was ill, and I wasn't allowed to go. And he was an older man, he would have been in his 20s, and he said, and I wasn't allowed to go, and all my friends were drowned on that boat. And he started crying, and it set me crying, and my husband said, what's the matter with you? And this poor little man crying about his friends on the boat. Oh dear. And so it was a very, very powerful thing, Dunkirk. In fact, we had a friend who was dropped, a parachute friend who came out of Dunkirk and went in -6 on D-Day too. They were terribly harrowing days, really.
What was your experience of the public morale in those days?
I think the public morale was brilliant. I think people like me, for instance, I was never late at work. Whatever the bombing, whatever we'd had, how many doors we'd lost overnight, whatever went on, I was at that work on time. There were books left out. You had to sign in your book at the bank in those days. It was a head office as well as a city office. It had thousands of employees there. Well, it's where the NatWest Tower is today. Only the building we worked in with the statues on the corner of Bishopsgate there is now preserved as a special building, and they did do some masterminds and things like that in it. It's an events building. Beautiful building. But I never saw it look so nice as when I went back to look in it, when it had become special. Because when we were there, it was all faded mirrors and, you know, paintwork peeling and this chicken wire over the dome. It was quite tatty. It's beautiful now. No, I think there was a wonderful sense of cooperation and seeing that what you did, at least you did. And that was the same in the Land Army. We did what we had to. I mean, there was nobody there looking after us, you know. There was at Exeter, there was the Land Army officer in charge of the girls. But I think we saw her once down in those woods. We got a telegram saying she was coming in case anybody had got their shirt off, you know, sort of thing. Because we had dungarees and a lot of girls. I never sunbathed because I can't, my skin doesn't take sunbathing. So, in fact, I had to go to the doctor when we were at Culford Camp for my skin swelling on account of the unaccustomed light after being in the basements of the bank so long. I think everybody had very good morale, at least the people I knew, to do what they had to do and to do it as well as they could.
What degree of concern was there over the likelihood of a German invasion during 1940 at least?
Well, we rather laughed about it actually, because, you know, my dad was
Home Guard.
Home Guard, yes, he was in that. And he was a small man. I mean, I'd take after him. Small hands, small. He had a pair of trousers that came up to his armpits. And we laughed so much about it. But he'd have given them what for, I'm sure. And he went to the meetings, and and I think everybody was, well, I think some plane was brought down at Victoria somewhere, and people rushed on a Sunday, and people rushed out with their carving knives. I don't think the man came to any harm, but I think there would have been a massacre there. I can't imagine that they'd have got very far. Extraordinary how my last note on that paper, one of my last notes is how going back from on that Whitsun holiday when we invaded them, I was on the train from night train from Paddington to go back to Cornwall after the bank holiday Whitsun, and you come out at Dawlish and go along the coast there on the train, and the whole sea was full of ships. From the whole channel, as far as you could see both ways and as far as you could see forward, there were warships, there were small... it was absolutely chock-a-block. And I said, well, if Hitler's got anybody looking out here, they'll know there's an invasion on. But they were all... They weren't even there, were they? I mean, the chap that was supposed to be in charge of that coast was celebrating some anniversary or the other. And so, I don't know. I mean, if I knew it on the early Tuesday morning and they didn't go that day because the weather wasn't right, if you remember that, they did the last day that they could do for the sea and the weather. But I just can't see that they'd have got in here, not with the cliffs around Dover and that sort of area. In fact, we stayed in the house that was nearest to France. One of our trips out was where they first practiced the radar system, and it was a decaying country house in very bad shape, and we rented it for a week, and the cliffs there were enormous, absolutely enormous. You couldn't, well, I suppose you could do an air invasion, but I think those people would have got really slaughtered. Whereas if you land in France, you see, you've got people who are supporting you. Wouldn't have had anybody supporting him there, I'm sure.
What was your experience of the rationing when it was introduced?
Well, I suppose it was very hard. I suppose we were prepared to eat what we could, you know. There was always a bit of bread, and there was always... I sometimes couldn't eat at all. I remember my mother, after one terrible night, and you see, sometimes you had no water in the morning unless you'd put kettles and things filled the night before. I mean, one day she cooked me she cooked me three eggs, and each one I couldn't eat. I don't know, or something. You feel, I don't know if you've been up all night, you feel your insides are all thrown about. So, you were lucky to have toast and sausage or something like that. Wasn't my kind of food. But I don't, and of course, Cornwall was the exact opposite. We ate too much in Cornwall. Too much rich stuff, too, cream and chicken and eggs and everything you can think of we had there. That was because our admirers brought them for us, you see.
Could you explain then how you came to join the Land Army and the...
I was called up. That was another thing. I was doing at the time a VAD training, and it was assumed I was going to go into the VAD like Peggy did. But I went to University College Hospital. I did my work all the week. I went to University College Hospital all day Sundays from 9 till 6, and Wednesdays from 6 till 9 after work. Then we were doing the training and the lessons and all that. And although I got 100% in the exam, which is the only exam I've ever had 100% for, I was always put on a women's cancer ward at University College. And I was, special treats. They'd take me round to see the dressings done, and that's what... I was so absolutely weary with the war and weary with the illness that at the end of all this, I just said, I really can't do it. Added to that VAD, you had to spend about £50 on your uniform.
What did VAD stand for?
Voluntary Aid Detachment. And I just felt I wanted to be out of London. It was just an escape, really. So I said to this lady who interviewed me that I would join the Land Army, and she said, well, you're not very big. And I said, well, no, but I can do things. She said, well, they are doing this course for measurers where you, and you've been in a bank and you do figures and she said you could do very well in a factory, with your qualifications. And I said, I don't want to be in, I just wanted to see some trees or something, because that's always been one of my passions, trees and flowers, and painting and drawing. And I just felt I couldn't take any more. So she said, oh, well, you can, I'll put you down to be a measurer. And when I went to this camp, Coldford Camp in Suffolk, there were only about 8 measurers out of the 120 girls that went there. But I was allowed to be one. And you got your training in different trees and different woods. But we all had to do the general course of sawmills. I found sawmills frightening out of beyond belief. Sawmills with these great toothed, I suppose it's not anything like as frightening these days, but they pushed them these great logs through with a stick, and you could cut your arm off on those. And the noise of it was enough. And so, as I'd been sent there as a measurer, I was taken as a measurer.
What was the role of a measurer?
Well, the role of the measurer was to keep the books, really, to calculate the amount of work each person had done. If you were paying piecework, like Ben Crocker, the gypsies dragged the poles down through the woods after they'd been cut. Well, the fellers were paid to piecework, and then the gypsies were paid piecework to drag the poles down to the cutting area, and then they were cut up. You had to keep an account of what everybody had done, and also I did the wages and the register and the invoices and saw the... We had a very special thing there where a train ran along beside the River Camel. We were billeted out in villages. We came to the railway line, which came from Wadebridge to Helland, and we turned in on the railway line and followed the River Camel and the railway line up to where our operation was, which was about a mile down the line. It was exquisitely beautiful. The train came through at just after 11 every day. It was the mineral line, I think. It went from Wadebridge to Helland, and it returned about just after 3 in the afternoon. If we were going to load some props or timber, we didn't have much timber, or sacks of charcoal, I would go to the end of the line and ring up the Wadebridge office for some trucks. They would attach them to the end of the train, and they would drop them off at our operation, and then would go on their work, whatever they were doing, and coming back, they would pick up our loaded trucks. They went to Welsh mines, and sometimes to Kent mines, and the charcoal went to pharmaceutical firm. I think they use it in refining for medicine. I'm not really quite sure what they did there. And now that track, there's no train, there's no railway, and it's a cycling and walking track from Wadebridge to Helland, and it's called the Camel Trail. Very, very beautiful, follows the River Camel along through the Bluebell Woods. Absolutely beautiful. And you would never know that we have ever been there. I was there last year and the year before. You would never know it. Absolutely exquisite, though.
What was your parents' reaction to your joining the Land Army?
Well, they knew I was called up. I'd got to go somewhere. They thought it was a bit far. Of course, you might have gone anywhere. I mean, some people went to Canada, didn't they, and trained there. So I don't mean Land Army people, but airmen went there. I suppose my mother missed my money because, you know, that we were still very close to the red line there. But as far as, I mean, she did very well on things like providing food. She took all her knowledge from St. Thomas's Hospital. It was a very important book written by, I think, Mrs. Pethick Lawrence, around about a pound a week before the First World War. And they set up classes at St. Thomas's for how you could live on a pound a week. Well, my mother had the £3, but she was paying rent, and she had three children. And she provided a protein and potatoes and a green vegetable every midday. There were no desserts, but you could have an apple or an orange if you wanted it. And the rest of the meals were bread and jam. But it didn't seem to do us any harm. We seemed to survive on it. And I should think that that's what went on through the war, though, I couldn't really eat breakfast after bombing raids, and I usually got something small out at the milk bar at the bank. and came home and probably snatched something before the bombing started. So I don't know how really we survived that so well. I wonder what people would do today. And my friend Margaret, she says, you know, we wouldn't win a war today if anybody started on us, because people haven't got that dedication to it.
How long were you training in Suffolk for?
Only 1 month. And then I was sent to the West Country. I think I was in Exeter for a day or two or a week maybe, before we were sent out on our various ploys. Bodmin was, I think, the last charcoal burning operation in the West Country. And that was quite kind of an unusual thing to be doing.
What was your first reaction then to arriving in Bodmin?
Well, I was met by the forewoman, who was same age as me. She had taken over only since Good Friday. Now, I went down there in May. Good Friday must have been in April, so she'd only been foreman since April, because the foreman, they were supposed to be working on Good Friday, and the foreman was drunk. She phoned up the Exeter office, and they came down and they sacked him, and made her the forewoman. And so she was about as new to it as I was. But she had more competence than I had. I didn't have the competence. I don't know that I could have run it, though in fact I did as much of the running as she did, really. We had a lot of people, you know. We had about 12 girls, Land Army girls. We had at the beginning 30 or 40 women that were bussed in from St Austell that were meant to clear the undergrowth. And they found that very expensive, I think. And in the end, after a few months, that was stopped. But we had quite a few local women from Bodmin. We had 5 or 6 boys who weren't of an age to be called up. And we had the gypsies with their horses. We had two gypsies with horses, and we had one of the girls' daughter called Fiance, but her name was Defiance. Extraordinary sort of name for a girl. And we had some older men that did felling, and one that ran the charcoal, really, because he lived in the woods. He had been in the First World War and was injured in the head. He had a silver plate in his head, and he couldn't live with ordinary people. He lived in a shack in the wood, and he was good at the charcoal business, because if you fired a kiln, you had to know when to shut it down so that it didn't burn away. And if it happened in the evening or the night, he was always there to do it. It was very dirty work, the charcoal. You sacked it. Girls had to get in the kilns to sack it, and come out very black. And it was very black to pack in the trucks too. Towards the end, the charcoal work finished, and we were just cutting props. It was all coppice. We didn't cut any valuable timber of any kind, no beech trees, just oak coppice. It probably was wood several hundred years old. It might have even been older, you know, might have gone back to the Elizabethan period, because they cut coppice continually and it grows up again and makes poles, straight poles for hedging and fencing sort of things.